Let me read to you a verse from Matthew 11, which I believe many of you will know. After an introduction like that, I think it's tremendously important that we hear the words of Jesus, because, I hate living up to that kind of intro, so let's look at this verse here in Matthew 11, verse 29. It says this: "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." Jesus says, learn from me. He says, the way that I do it is the way that you need to do it. The way that I live is the way that you need to live. And for me, I've often found myself at a distance from Jesus himself, doing something that's kind of in between Jesus and the world. It's kind of a mediated program that's attempting to do something good, to do something effective, often doing something great. But I find myself at a distance from Jesus, and for that reason, I've committed myself more and more to actually find out what it is that he said and what it is that he did so that I can do those things. And in doing that, draw nearer to him and find by the presence of his Spirit that I'm more in communion with him day to day. The word that he uses, the word learn, is the same root word as he uses in the Great Commission at the end of Matthew's Gospel when he says, go and make disciples. The word is mathetes. And the word to learn or the word to disciple is the same thing. It means that we learn from him. Recently, I had an interesting illustration of some of this and some of the necessary transitions that need to take place in my own life. I travel quite a bit right now. The family is at such a state that I'm able to do that, and it seems to be part of the package right now. And of course, when you accumulate sufficient air miles and when you find kind people in America who'll fly you business class, then you end up in one of these business lounges, which are great. I mean, I like them. And you get to the airport, and you always try to find them because, you know, you don't want to kind of spend your time with the hoi polloi, the ragtag and bobtails of life. You want to be more with people of your own class and culture. And so, you know, I make a beeline for the information desk and ask them, you know, where's the lounge? And on one particular occasion, I think it was Cincinnati. They said, you have to go up that lift. And, of course, that's an elevator to you, but I think they knew that I was English, and so they called it that. And it was a big kind of steel tube that obviously gave you access to the pleasure dome above. And there was only one button. It just had, you know, just one button. So I pressed the button, and sure enough, the doors opened. And I went in and turned around and saw that there were just a few lights. One was a light that indicated the floor that I was on, and the other was another light to indicate the floor that I wanted to get to. So I pressed the button indicating the floor that I was after, which was the only button available, and waited. And sure enough, the lift moved, and then stopped. And I looked, and the light indicated that that I was at the floor, but the doors wouldn't open. And, you know, I tried to. And then the lift moved again, and I went down, and the doors opened, and I was on the same floor that I'd started. And I thought, this is not right. So I went over to the information desk and said, are you sure that's the right thing? And they said, oh, yeah, that's the one. So I went back, and I thought, you know, maybe they found out that I'm not really of that class and breed of people. And I need some kind of swipe card or something, you know, to get me beyond. So I pressed again and went up, and sure enough, it stopped again. And I'm thinking, man, what is the deal here? And I'm looking at the doors and looking around and thinking. And as I'm thinking, the lift moves again and goes back down again. Doors open, I'm back where I started. I thought, this is awful. So I went to the information desk. I said, you know, I've been up and down in that lift, and the doors don't open. And they said, have you tried turning around? So I went back into the lift, and sure enough, when the lift stopped, I looked behind me, and there's the lady at the desk going, hi. So with my dignity in tatters, I entered the business lounge. I wonder what they thought as they saw me kind of looking like this and thinking, what am I going to do now? And the third time, they must have thought, well, you know, we'll send somebody in there to get him. Well, maybe you feel like that when you start approaching some of the subjects that we're dealing with today, because, quite frankly, the training that I've had in theological college, accumulating several degrees and then reading and seeking as much experience and input as I can, has ill-equipped me to disciple others. Because the discipleship process is a process where you invite someone to imitate your life. You invite someone to imitate your life. And here's the big question. Does anybody want your life? Quite frankly, the average congregant, the average person in our church would not want our life. They see the way that we live, they see the way that we're treated, they see the way that we function, and quite honestly, it's not a life that they want. And yet, Jesus says, go and make disciples. Go and disciple people, teaching them to do everything that I've taught you to do. And it's quite clear, the only means by which that can take place is that people imitate our lives as we imitate Christ. It is information, but it's not information that leads to more information. It's information that leads to transformation. And so therefore, that kind of information, the scriptures would call revelation. Now, when we look at our approach to things, we generally have this operating system. We have the church, which has inherited a great wealth of truth. That truth comes to us, obviously, through the scriptures, but often is mediated to us through our denominational history, through our experiential engagement with theology and practice. And so the church and its history, its background, and its traditions have become our operating system. Now, what I mean by that is that it's the underlying, the largely unseen means by which we interpret the world and as it were, launch or establish our behavior in that world. The church becomes our operating system, and we've called it in different times different things, but Christendom is one of them. And around the church, there is a fringe of people who are either on their way in or on their way out of church. These are the de-churched or the unchurched. The unchurched have made an even more perilous journey from here. And by and large, our methods have, in the last 50 years, have reflected a need to refine the model of Christendom, which has been functioning for an awful long time now, perhaps as long as 1700 years, to refine the model of Christendom, which is to get as many people to worship with us as possible. And so the journey that we're seeking people to make is a journey towards us. And hopefully the people who are beginning to make a journey away from us, we can turn them around as well. And so the unchurched become churched, and the de-churched become churched again. And so our strategies of evangelism and outreach are basically strategies of in-drag rather than outreach. Our strategies of reaching the world are strategies of the world coming to us. And so we seek to develop methods and models and means of encouraging people to come into our world. And that, by and large, is the way in which we have been programmed. It's the way in which we've been hardwired, both through our theological education, in formal seminaries and the like, and also through our ecclesiological education through the churches that we belong to. If we can put on a good enough show, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, if we can put on a good enough attractional activity, then people will make the perilous journey towards us. Now, within a world where we pretty much own the culture, a world that is defined by the parameters of a Judeo-Christian ethic, a world that is defined by the infrastructure and expectations of Christendom, then you're fine. I mean, if everybody basically believes what you and I believe, then really what we need to do is to get them close enough to us to really get it. And there are places within the North American continent where Christendom is still alive and kicking. But frankly, those places are fewer and fewer. And the reality of our lives is that we are seeing a massive transition taking place in our world. I've just returned from Australia and New Zealand. Just flew in yesterday afternoon. And whilst I was there, I was reminded again of Napier, a place that I've written of with Walt in the book called The Passionate Church. Napier is a city on the east coast of the North Island of New Zealand that was destroyed in 1931 by a massive earthquake. Every building was shaken to the ground. And then each of those buildings that was shaken to the ground was then consumed in the firestorm that followed. Astonishingly, the population survived largely intact. But this was a devastating catastrophe. A year later, they began to rebuild the city, and so most of the city is emblazoned with the year 1932 and is built in the Art Deco architectural form. And so many people go there today to see what an Art Deco city looks like. But I often wonder what the people felt like as they emerged from the rubble of their lives on February the 3rd, 1931, mid-morning. The breakfast had now well and truly settled in their stomachs. They were beginning to look forward to lunch, and suddenly their worlds changed. The mountain that became a bluff jutting out into the Pacific had fallen into the sea. The plain to the northwest had become a series of low rolling hills, and the lagoon where the fishing fleet was harbored, where many of the men were employed, was now dry land, and all of the boats were above seawater. I wonder what they felt like. I wonder what the people of Pakistan felt like just recently when 3 million of them were found to be homeless after that enormous earthquake. What they feel like is a massive level of disorientation. And the culture that is emerging around us is emerging through sociological seismic activity. The world around us is revealing fault lines below the surface that have been hidden for generations and are now beginning to move. And sociologists and political commentators and missiologists alike are all using the vocabulary of the earthquake to describe what it is that's happening. They speak of seismic change. They speak of social upheaval. They speak even in particularities of tectonic plates and fault lines. What they're saying to us and what we're experiencing as leaders and pastors is a world that is in such rapid change that at any other time in history, it would have been called chaos. It's only our huge level of affluence and financial freedom that enables us to move through this time of massive change in such relative ease. I say that because the relative ease is somewhat deceptive. There are huge and mounting evidences in people's lives of the stress that they've been suffering for the last generation. Stress-related diseases, stress-related social and relational breakdown are all around us, and you deal with them every day. And they're on the increase. The world is being shaken. And as the writer to the Hebrews says in chapter 12, the shaking of the world is revealing that which is unshakable. The shaking of the nations reveals that there is a kingdom that does not shake. And our task is to try to minister in the midst of that. Now, just think about it for a moment. If you were emerging from an earthquake, and actually you are, it's just that we don't think about it that much, but the social earthquake that we've been through is so enormous that our lives are entirely different from those of our parents and certainly from those of our grandparents. And do you know what? There's never been a generation like that in all the history of the world that's been through so much change. If you and I were going through a physical earthquake and somebody came to us the next day and said, you know, there are one or two buildings that are still standing. Why don't you come into them? What would you do? You would offer them an alternative in the nicest possible way, I'm sure. And you would suggest that they go and try someone else to invite into their building. You see, the fabric of our society is being shaken, and the institutions that were the solid blocks of our society are being shaken with it. Take family life. 100 years ago, the extended family was the cornerstone of human society right throughout the Western world. Some of the ravages of slavery and industrialization had begun to break up the tendency that people have always had to gather into extended family groups. But still, the extended family was the most stable reality within our social fabric. By the time the Second World War had occurred, halfway through the 20th century, the extended family was almost completely gone. So then we began to speak of family as the nuclear family. Mom, dad, 2 and a bit children. Within 50 years, the nuclear family too has been shaken to its roots. And we know the statistics. The interesting thing for me in developing a different approach to church and community life is that in the 10 years that I led the church in Sheffield, as the people gathered, and all of these were generally young people, and they began to pair off and get married, what we discovered was this. As they took on a new operating system, it changed their approach to relationships. And to this day, 12 years later, not one person has been divorced. Not one person has been divorced. Now, I wasn't even trying for that. But 10 years is a pretty long time to test a theory, especially when you're not trying to test a theory. You see, what is being shaken is being shaken so that what is unshakable is revealed. And if we can have that unshakable reality at the center of our lives, then our lives become stable. Our lives become touched by the unshaking and the unmoving reality, rather than by the culture around us, which is collapsing. Why is it that that young people that you know, maybe your own children, find it difficult to think about getting married? Well, they look at that building and they say, "You want me to go in there? Don't you know that they're all falling down? Don't you know it's dangerous? Don't you know the roof falls in on people? Don't you know that when you go into marriage, you get children, and that means that the most vulnerable get crushed when the earthquake comes? Don't you realize that?" And we can't work it out. You know, us who are a little bit older, we look at it and we say, well, you know, what's the problem? The problem is not anything that's able to be particularly articulated at an intellectual level. It's a visceral thing. It's a gut thing. You just wouldn't go into a building in the midst of an earthquake. You'd get out of it. Why don't young people get involved in politics? Well, that roof fell in too, didn't it? Why don't young people go to church? Well, the roof fell in for them. And everything that they see that is presented in the outside world, and I know it's not fair, but everything they see reminds them that the church that they understand to be the organized church is dangerous too. It's a scary place. You would have a very hard job selling people space in the houses that were still up after the earthquake, because nobody wants to go in there. So the operating system, which we have understood, needs to be rethought. Christendom is all but a spent force. We no longer own the culture. The culture, fortunately, doesn't own us, but the culture is in transition. So what do we do about that? If our operating system has been the church and our modus operandi, our basic way of operating, has been to get people to come to the organized meetings of church, how do we function? Well, what you do is you go back to Jesus. You see, if you were in an earthquake as catastrophic as that happened in Napier, the maps would no longer work. You would need somebody to rewrite the maps. But to rewrite the maps, you need a compass. And that's why the writer to the Hebrews, as he continues his train of thought into chapter 13, says this: "Remember your leaders who spoke the word of God to you. Consider the outcome of their life." In other words, Remember the people who have been your disciples and look at the way in which your disciples have lived their lives and model yourself on them. And then he goes on to say, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He is the compass. He is the reference point in a changing world. He is the point of orientation. He is the one who we can look to as the North Star. A point of orientation that will never change. So, let's ask ourselves this question. What was the operating system of Jesus? Well, this is how I would put it. I would say that the operating system of Jesus was discipleship and not the local church. Now, I know that's scary because, you know, we're employed to look after the local church and we're employed by it. And the local church seems to be the principal means by which God has done things in these last 2,000 years. And I think that that's still going to be the case. But don't you find it interesting that Jesus only mentions the church twice in all four Gospels? Once in Matthew 16 and once in Matthew 18. Once when he says, I'm building the church, and the other time when he gives the disciples a means by which they can hold one another accountable in their relationships one to another, so that if personal relationships break down and witnesses can't be brought to bring reconciliation, then you take it to the church. You see, the operating system for Jesus was discipleship because discipleship creates church. Discipleship creates church. You see, church is an effect, not a cause. Church is an effect, not a cause. Jesus gathers his disciples, disciples them, and what happens on the day of Pentecost is you get a church. And they continue with the same operating system, discipling the people, having them imitate their lives, and what do you get? More church. Church is an effect, not a cause. The operating system of Jesus is discipleship. Now, let's explore the metaphor of operating system a little more. Recently, you will have been, I'm sure, aware of the phenomenal success of Apple as a corporation and as a computer and software house. Up until recently, Apple was for a group of, well, at least esoteric computer users. They believed that it was the real thing, you know, that everything had been invented by Apple, but it was a kind of a boutique thing. You know, it was for the hardcore geekdom crowd. Now, I don't use that in any way to suggest that, you know, the people who inhabit geekdom are any more valuable to society than anyone else. The fact is, of course, that they run everything now. But it's interesting, isn't it, what's happened to Apple? I think its share price has gone from, what is it, $7 to $74? I mean, amazing. And it's happened just in a few years. Well, I've been looking into this, and like you, I'm sure, have been reading it in the kind of the popular magazine press, and the story basically is this. The previous CEO, one day, said to his board of directors, it's time for me to leave. Literally, that's what he said, and he walked out. And who walked in but Steve Jobs? Now, some of them had known him before. He'd been this kind of slightly maverick renegade character who obviously had pushed over the trellises one too many times and was asked to leave a few years earlier. But now he was back in his shorts and in his T-shirt, and he walked into the board of directors' meeting room and put his feet up on the desk and said, our products suck. That's the problem with Apple. And the directors, recognizing that this was the new CEO, felt that they ought to agree with him. So they were, oh, yeah, that's right, absolutely, yeah. Now, what happened after that is becoming something of the kind of technological folklore. What happened after that is really remarkable. But it was based on an operating system. What actually happened was this, that Steve Jobs left Apple Corporation, went off and looked into the development of a much more powerful operating system, which is called OS X and is written as OS X for those of us who are uninitiated. This operating system used the most powerful programming language that was publicly available, but which, up until that point, really no one had felt that they could kind of wrestle to the ground and use in any practical way for you and I. I mean, it was a academic, it was highly technologically advanced programming system that was in the realm of academia, largely. It was called Unix. He took this programming language and, by working with it and persisting with it, came up with an amazing operating system. And that operating system runs my iPod. And my iPod has got, I don't know, 300 different pieces of music on, two series of Lost, a couple of series of Monk. This thing's amazing. And it's the same operating system that runs the iMac and will run the iPhone. That'll be a fun thing to come out, won't it? They cut down all of their products. What they did is they decided that the language was the right one. The operating system was really useful. And so they had some applications that were really useful. And everybody wants one, even me. Everybody wants one. Well, I believe that the programming language of Jesus is obviously the scriptures, and the DNA of the Bible is covenant and kingdom. Jesus was a Bible man and was always referring to the scriptures. And out of that, he discipled people. And what happened was church and everything else. Our problem is that this has come to here, and it doesn't always work. It doesn't always work. And it may be working great for you, but you know what? There are thousands of pastors who are saying, the operating system doesn't work anymore. The maps don't seem to work. They look at the world and they say, well, I got this map at seminary, and I don't know, it doesn't seem to work. Or they get a map from a place where things are slightly more stable and slightly more sustainable and slightly more predictable, and they buy in a map and they call it a church program, and they look at it and then they say, well, wait a minute, this doesn't work because it doesn't quite tie in to their points of orientation because they keep on moving. And it's for those reasons that over the years, as I've spent time in urban communities that have been suffering the shaking before the rest of us, as I've been working with non-literate, post-book generations that new ways of trying to teach people and to get them back to Jesus have begun to develop. The shapes, as we call them, life shapes, are basically the things that we found Jesus taught, and we just organize them into simple shapes that people can remember. Almost all of these shapes you can find on most streets, right the way up to the eighth shape, which I believe over here is a stop sign. Though not being a person that likes to stop very often, maybe I don't see them that much, but I think that that's correct. Now, you've got in your material in front of you a lot of those shapes, and we've got all of the resources out there, although I saw a lot of you buying them before you got to this session. Maybe you thought that they'd go at the end of the session, and so you were predicting the rush. You've got a lot of the material in front of you. I wonder which one you'd like me to speak about, because obviously, eight principles of Jesus can't be taught in a session like this. I've been spending most of my time trying to get you to think through why you need a different operating system. The first shape is how Jesus taught his disciples to learn from him. How do they learn? What does it actually mean to be a disciple, to be a learner? What does it mean? The second shape is how are we to be fruitful and maintain a healthy balance in life? The third shape is how do we understand the framework of life? How do we maintain the right balance between all of the different demands of life? The fourth shape is how did Jesus lead other people and how did he teach them to lead? The fifth shape is what is the ministry of Jesus and how is it distributed across his people? The sixth shape is how did Jesus pray and how did he teach his disciples to pray? The seventh shape is how did Jesus teach people to understand the work of God's Spirit in their lives as they begin to flow in the life of God? The eighth shape is how to witness, how to share your faith in a grace-filled, lightweight, low-maintenance fashion. Let's do a quick vote. Who wants me to teach on the circle? Who wants me to teach on the semicircle? Who wants me to teach on the triangle? It's going to be great. If you don't want anything to be done, then I'll be able to finish in a real short time. How many of you want me to teach on the square? Okay, how many of you want me to teach on the pentagon? How many of you want me to teach on the hexagon, the prayer thing? How many of you on the Holy Spirit dimension? And how many of you want me to teach the last shape, which is how to witness? Looks like the last one got it. Okay, here it is, real simple. If you turn to Luke chapter 10, you'll discover how Jesus taught his disciples how to witness. In Luke 10, we have teaching that Jesus has already given to the 12 disciples. The 12 disciples have had this teaching given to them in Luke 9, and then back into Mark's gospel in Mark 6, and back into Matthew's gospel in Matthew 10. But here in Luke's gospel, he sends out another group of disciples, a group of disciples called the 72. They're other disciples, and I find it encouraging that there are people who are unnamed, who are disciples, but they're not the 12. And so we don't have to kind of aspire to be Peter or James. We can aspire to be just one of the 72. And the 72 are sent out with exactly the same strategy as as Jesus gave the 12. And the strategy is this. You go with a team. That means that as you go to take on the mission of God, you never go alone. We don't teach people to be individuals. We teach them to function in community. Ecclesiastes 4 says, two are better than one. That's the basic reason. So we go as a team. We go at a particular time. It's called harvest time. Jesus, living in an agrarian world, knew that harvest followed the growing period, followed the sowing period, followed the plowing period. There were various phases to the agricultural year, and when you get to harvest, then you bring the harvest in. Jesus is identifying a season. He says the harvest is plentiful. On another occasion in John 4, he says, open your eyes and look. The harvest is ready and ripe. That opening of our eyes is something that we look at when we look at the first shape in life shapes. We don't have time to look into that right now. Jesus says, go as a team. When he wanted a donkey, he sent two disciples. He really believes in teams. We don't send people out by themselves. We don't make employment strategies out of individuals. We begin to think of our staff as teams and teams of teams. And we train our congregation to do the same thing. We have a team. We have a time. That means that we learn to identify when it is harvest. We learn to have our eyes open. We learn to recognize where things are ripening. Is the harvest right now amongst the children? Well, let's deploy the harvesters there. Is it amongst the youth? Well, let's deploy the harvesters there. Is it amongst the elderly? Is it amongst... well, who is it amongst? Well, how would we know? Well, you would know because Jesus says there is a specific target. And that target is defined by him as a particular kind of person. After he's given them these amazingly encouraging words, go, I'm sending you out like lambs among wolves, he says in verse 5, when you enter a house, first say peace to this house. If a man of peace is there, your peace will rest on him. If not, it will return to you. Stay in that house, eating and drinking what they give you, for the worker deserves his wages. Do not move around from house to house. What is he saying? He's saying there is a person that has been prepared in advance for you, and they will indicate to you that God is at work. And the way that you'll know who these people are and the way that you'll recognize the harvest is by their response to you. Their immediate response to you is this: they like you. They welcome you. And so we learn from Jesus that the principal way to do witnessing and to do evangelism is to be able to identify the people whom he has been at work in and who want to be with us, rather than the great trophies of grace that we would love to put on our mantle. You know, those kind of really scary ones that we focus on and we think it'd be great if they came in. No, the Lord is working in people's lives, and I've seen it hundreds and hundreds of times, that as you teach people the person of peace strategy, that they suddenly begin to see that it's not about them straining at the bit, trying to make something happen. No, it's much more about recognizing what God's already doing. Who are the people that like you? Why would people like you anyway? It must be something that God's done in you. Because the scriptures tell us that there's nothing likable in us. No, God is working in a person's life to connect them heart to heart. And as we connect heart to heart with them, then we can begin to draw them to Jesus as we disciple them. I don't know how many times it's happened. One of the first time it happened, there was this young man looking over the fence of the yard that I was trying to mow in inner city London, and he was shouting out in his Cockney accent, "Oi, vicar, what you doing?" And boy, this kid was such a pain in the neck. Eventually, my wife said to me, she said, "You've been teaching on this person a piece. Do you think he might be one?" Oh, God, I'm so sorry. You know, because I'd had all these hateful thoughts about this kid that was always being a pain. So every day I was out in the yard hoping that he would come past. And he never did. Not for maybe 10 days. He got run over and had his leg broken and eventually hobbled past. And I thought, well, I'll do something. I'll just say hello at least. So I went over to the fence and said hello. And he said, "Oh, nice to see you, vicar." I said, "Yeah, it's good to see you." And he told me his name. He was from an Irish family. And he said that he wanted to play the guitar when he was older and become a professional musician. And I said, "Oh, so what kind of guitar have you got?" He said, "Oh, I haven't got one yet." And I thought, uh-oh, I'm getting myself embroiled here in a conversation I can't get out of. He says, "I'm buying one this Saturday from the junk shop around the corner. I've seen one in the window. You need a guitarist, don't you, in your group at church?" I said, "Well, how much have you learned?" He said, "Well, I've not learned anything." He said, "But I could play if you want." So what am I supposed to do? This is the person of peace. It's quite clear. He's completely open. Well, now what am I supposed to do? Eat what is put before you, says Jesus. Don't move around from house to house. I said to him, "Do you know what? Cockle," that was his name. I said, "Why don't you join the team, and we probably won't plug you in straight away. And just kind of strum along in the background and see whether you pick things up." Well, he's a professional guitarist today. He did pick things up quite quickly and became a Christian immediately, as did his brother and sister. She's a missionary. He's a full-time Christian worker. His parents became Christians. He took us into his school. Dozens of young people came to the Lord through this young man. Just recently, I was in Orlando at a conference. And, you know, you have these passing relationships. The eighth shape gives you lots of different strategies for identifying the person of peace. Sometimes they're permanent relationships. Sometimes they're passing. This was a passing relationship. I'm there speaking to Janet, one of the directors of our publishing house, and I'm chatting to her, and there's a young man over in the corner, well-dressed African-American young guy, and he's on his computer, and I can see that he's listening to our conversation, because he's kind of paused over the keyboard like this, and he's doing more listening than writing. And eventually, in Starbucks, he gets up and comes over to me and says, "Do you know something about the Bible?" I said, "A little bit." He said, he says, "Do you know anything where it says in the Bible about adultery?" This is in Starbucks. I said, "Yeah. Why?" He says, "Well, I've got this friend who's probably committing adultery right now." I said, "Oh, got a friend, huh?" And so he told me about this friend. And I directed him to some scriptures, and I said, "Have you got a Bible?" He says, "Well, yeah, I do have a Bible." And I said, "Well, you want to look in this particular part in the Sermon on the Mount?" And he said, "Oh, that's really helpful." I said, "You know, it'll really help you if you get to know what it is that Jesus wants to say to you about these things." And he says, "Yeah, absolutely." And left Starbucks. It's a funny thing, isn't it, that people do that kind of stuff? But you see, Jesus says, look for the person of peace. And if we train our people this way, and if we live this way ourselves, they'll have something to imitate. And we'll be able to give them not only the team and the time and the target, but the task, which for some reason has become brown instead of black. Oh, there's the pen down there. The task, and the task is simply this. It's just normal stuff, says Jesus. What you do is you heal the sick, you raise the dead, you cast out demons. You know, just the normal kind of discipleship deal. And you tell them that the kingdom of God is near. That's what you do. That's the task when you find the person of peace. In other words, what you do is this. You ask them what it is that they would like God to do in their life. What would you like God to do in your life? Yes, I know we're itching to share with them the four spiritual laws. I know that we've got that new track that we've just developed and designed that's A to E, and it's great. But Jesus didn't operate that way. It was a relational approach. He wanted them to connect relationally so that they could receive far more than just a series of things. He said, you need to demonstrate by word and work that God is with them. Ask people, what do you need God to do in your life? And then you say, well, you know what? I'm going to ask him to do that. And when you start to operate that way, you discover that Jesus keeps his promise. And he answers our prayers in the most astonishing ways. You see, the model is a discipleship model. The operating system is to discover what Jesus said, what Jesus did, and do that. And then we discover it's what Jesus is still saying and what Jesus is still doing. And we find ourselves incredibly close to him. And we have this sense of communion with him that perhaps we never had because we walk with him in what it is that he's about. Just before I came here, I joined a gym in Sheffield to kind of prepare myself for the incredibly high standards of health and fitness that I would discover in the population that I was going to be ministering in. And we joined the gym, me and the family, Sally, my wife, and Rebecca and Elizabeth and Sam. Becky was, I think, at the time, 20, and Libby was 18, and Sam was 14, I think. And we went there, had all the normal instruments of torture, you know, you do the normal things, and the rack, and the, you know, all of those different things. And then you go off and cool off in the pool area afterwards, and we went in the pool, and, you know, as weeks wore on, we found ourselves more often in the pool than in the torture chamber, but, you know, we still turned up. That was the most important thing. And one day, me and Sally was in the hot tub, and the girls came over to me and said, Dad, you've got to try this new thing. I said, what new thing? They said, that thing over there on the side of the pool, it's that white tube. It's called a sun shower. I said, well, what is it? They said, well, it gives you this kind of effect of the sun, and it'll give you a tan if you stay in there long enough, but the real thing is that it just makes you feel fantastic. You feel this breeze and this heat, and you can almost smell the beach in South Carolina. I said, whoa, sounds amazing. How much does it cost? They said, it costs £1 for 3 minutes. So I said, okay, we'll get. So they gave me the £1 coin. I went over there and closed the door, and I was quite kind of excited. I read through all of the stuff. You know, you want to make sure that this is kind of safe. So I read through all these several languages. The Japanese was a bit challenging, and kind of got to the end of that and put the goggles on. Couldn't see anything. So took the goggles off and put the coin in and put the thing on. Stood there. The whole thing's kind of moving and whirring and clicking and 3 minutes, like this. Got to the end of the 3 minutes. I thought, I didn't get any of that. I didn't get any sun. There's no breeze. There's definitely no South Carolinian experience. So I came out, and I was a bit crestfallen. The girl said, what do you think? I said, I didn't get it. He said, oh, Dad, you know, they assume every time that I'm like that, that I'm kind of pulling their leg or, you know. And he said, oh, Dad, go on, tell us what you're. I honestly, I didn't get it. They said, well, you've got to try it again. I said, well, I don't know. I mean, I didn't enjoy it the first time. I don't think I want to do it again. Well, the next week they came back and they said, Dad, you've got to try it again. I said, but girls, it was awful. No, have a go. And so, you know, it went backwards and forwards. But these, after all, are daughters, and I'm a dad. What am I supposed to do? So I said, okay, well, what do you want me to do? They said, well, do 6 minutes. I said, okay. Is that 2 pounds? They gave me the 2 pound coins. I went to the machine, read through everything, made sure I didn't miss anything. Maybe there was something in the Japanese I'd missed. I put the goggles on, still couldn't see anything. Come on, took the goggles off, put the coins and put the goggles down. Come on, come on. 6 minutes, nothing. It was awful. I got to the end of it. I thought, I don't want to see the girls again. It's awful. They said, what do you think, Dad? I said, girls, maybe it's because I'm old. I don't get it. They said, well, you've got to try it again. I said, I don't want to try it again. It was awful. I got cramps in my legs. I just don't want to do it anymore. They said, oh, Dad, go on. I said, no, I don't want to. They said, go on. I said, look, I'll see. And all parents know that that means I hope you forget before I have to. Next week, this is absolutely true. Next week they came to me and they said, Dad, we've decided it is because you're old. You've got to try 9 minutes. I said, oh, please. I could see my life ebbing away, you know. If it didn't work this time, I could be in there all week. Can you imagine? I looked across at Sally. Sally gave me one of those wifely looks, which, you know, roughly translated goes, you got yourself into it, now get yourself out of it. So I said to the girls, look, what do you want me to do? They said, do 9 minutes. I said, oh, please. I'm starting to pray now. I took the coins. I went to the machine. I read through everything. Maybe there was something I missed. I put the coins in, put the goggles on. It's an awfully long time, 9 minutes. So I tried to open my eyes behind the goggles and found I could see. It was amazing. I started to look around and I thought, well, maybe I got close to those hook things. Maybe that's what scatters the rays or something. So I kind of got close to those. Nothing. There's this concave mirror that made you look rather slim. I like that. I thought, maybe if I got a bit closer to that, maybe the effects would be... Just here, I saw a door handle. I tried it, and it opened. Inside, there were lights on. I'd been stood in the changing room for 3 weeks. I went in. It's fantastic. The heat, the wind. Oh, I came out and I think, oh, I've got to do that every week. It's wonderful. I loved it. You see, I think many of us and many of our people are in the changing room. We've heard the experience. And we tried to emulate it. We even tried to put more money in, hoping that we'll get it back. The real experience is following Jesus. It's following Jesus. He comes to us and fills our life by Spirit so that we can do what He does and live as He lives. The real thing is following Jesus. Let's pray briefly together. Lord, thank you so much that you make it clear, abundantly clear, that the way that you want us to function, the way that you want us to be, is to focus on you and follow you. To focus on you and follow you and invite others to follow too, that as they imitate our lives, they imitate you, the one that we're following. Jesus, thank you that you're the same yesterday, today, and forever. And thank you, Lord, that you say to us that we are blessed because we have not seen, because we walk by faith and not by sight. And so, Lord, we choose again this day and recommit ourselves again this day to making our operating system following you. And Jesus, we commit ourselves in this way, in your name.